You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 518. Assumptions allow the best in life to pass you by. John Sayles.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's film, B-I-Z, book.com. Guys, I have an immense treat for you today. I had the pleasure of speaking to the legendary independent filmmaker, writer-director, John Sayles. Now, if you're not familiar with John's work, he is pretty much almost at the beginning of independent film as we know it in the 70s coming up. And it was just an absolute pleasure talking to him. Some of the projects he's worked on are Eight Men Out, City of Hope, Passion Fish, Men of War, Lone Star, Men with Guns, Sunshine State, and so many more. He is a two-time Oscar-nominated writer. And if that wasn't enough, he also directed some of Bruce Springsteen's most iconic music videos, kind of like that little song called Born in the USA and a couple other ones that Bruce did. And if you don't know who Bruce is, please, for God's sakes, Google it. Anyway, I had an amazing conversation with John. I was in awe of the knowledge bombs he was dropping, the nuggets of gold he was just spitting out throughout this entire conversation. I literally went back to this interview and started to take notes again because it was literally a masterclass sitting in front of a master and listening to him talk about his craft, how he writes, how he directs. Specifically, there's a great part about how he directs actors. You know, and I've been doing this 25 years and I was learning stuff left and right. It was absolutely remarkable. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with John Sayles. I'd like to welcome to the show John Sayles. How you doing, John?
Good.
Thank you so much for coming on the show, my friend. I truly, truly appreciate it. Like I told you off air, I'm a huge fan of your work over the years. And when I was coming up in the 90s as a film student, you know, Lone Star and Eight Men Out and all of those films really had a big impact on me. So I'm excited to get into it with you, my friend.
Great.
So first of all, how did you start this insane journey of being a filmmaker?
You know, I started really just telling stories. I certainly grew up watching more TV and movies than I did reading books, although I did read books. I did some acting in college and directing of theater in college. The college I went to didn't have a theater major. And certainly didn't have a film major back in 1970 or whatever it was. There were, you know, maybe about four film schools at that time. I didn't go to any of them. and so I started out basically having this kind of long distance Jones for, wouldn't it be great to make a movie? I didn't know anybody who had ever made a movie or been in one. I didn't know anybody who'd written a book or gotten one published. But I did. I was working just kind of straight jobs and started sending off short stories to magazines. Got one published, got another one that the company said, well, could you expand this into a novel? And so I started as a novelist. I wrote two novels and a short story collection. And then a friend of mine who had produced and directed the summer theater I'd worked in, who I'd gone to college with, said, you know, we know so many, you know, good actors. And I had just started getting work as a screenwriter in Hollywood. Somebody had read one of my short stories. They worked for Roger Corman. He said, well, let's get this guy and see if he can do anything. I wrote Piranha for him, which was a very successful New World picture. Then I wrote two other movies for Roger, and he was at that time a signatory to the Writers Guild, so I had to get paid minimum, which was $10,000 for a screenplay.
Which I'm sure he hated.
Well, he wasn't a signatory to the Directors Guild, so Joe Dante, who directed Piranha, got $8,000, which was well below the guild minimum at that time.
Right.
But I had $30,000 in one place at one time. I figured, when is this ever going to happen again? My friend who had run the summer theater I've worked in just said, well, let's make a movie. And so I wrote Return to the Walk of Seven. And it's really the only time I've done this where I said, here's how much money I have. Let me write something I can do well for that budget.
Sure.
And I, you know, I had some vague idea about what, you know, camera rental of a 16 millimeter camera and all that, you know, very little idea really, because there weren't books about filmmaking or
YouTube. Podcasts
yet. Yeah. There wasn't internet yet. And so it was kind of on the job training. And I had 5 weeks to shoot. And we rented this old ski lodge near the theater that we had worked in, that we had lived in before, which became housing, set, you know, office. Nothing I shot was more than a 5 mile radius from that. The movie was full of people who were right around 30, who were good actors, but not quite in the Actors Guild yet. And it was about people turning 30. So it was very much tailored to, as I said, what I could do for very little money. I had a crew of seven who had made commercials in Boston, but never a feature before. They had 16 millimeter film equipment and could rent the rest of it. And on the first day, my first shot, I did a not that complicated tracking shot and timed how long it took to, you know, get done. And I decided no more tracking shots in this movie.
Lock the
camera and a little bit of handheld. And we got it made somehow, and then got it made. I edited it just through a friend of a friend. We got a recommendation to submit it to a couple film festivals. One, the FilmX Festival, which used to be in Los Angeles, good festival. And then the New Directors Festival in New York. And we got into both of those. And this is 1978. There's about five, maybe six independent distributors who they'd watch anything with sprocket holes, you know.
Right.
Like, the head of the company would watch anything with sprocket holes because there was so little competition. And so we had about three companies bidding for it. We went with a guy who owned theaters in Seattle, Randy Finley. He had a company, and then he realized he really didn't know anything about east of the Mississippi. So he went partners with another of the bidders on the film, Ben Barinholtz, who had a company in New York. And Ben kind of invented the midnight movie and, you know, had a long track record. And together they got the movie a pretty good distribution.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
That's awesome. We never made that many prints. We probably had 10 prints in all. And we would play an area, you know, a region, and then move those prints to another region and move those prints to another region. didn't do TV advertising. We did a lot of radio advertising. Right. And word of mouth. And in those days, off Hollywood theater, if they were doing well with a movie, they'd just keep it on the screen.
Yeah, because there's no competition. There was nothing. There was no content. They needed content.
Yeah. But you would get in a situation like in Chicago, the art theater in those days was the Biograph, which is where John Dillinger was shot. And it was the only show in town for a non-Hollywood movie in Chicago. And I remember My Brilliant Career was doing very, very well. So we were in a holding pattern over Chicago until that started to do less business. And then we came in and did 7 or 8 weeks, which you just don't get to do anymore.
Yeah, it was a whole other world back then. And then also that film got submitted or got into the film registry, the U.S. film registry. Is that correct?
Eventually, yeah.
Yeah, that's – what was – I mean, seriously,
That's a phenomenon, I think, you know, just kind of, you know, because – it was kind of the beginning of the American independent movement. All theaters showing American independent films starring nobody you ever heard of.
Right. It was the Sundance movement before there was Sundance. It was kind of like what the 90s.
About 3 years before Sundance, I actually went to something called
with the USA,
the Park City Film Festival.
Okay.
Which the next year became the USA Film Festival. It was basically the Denver Film Festival. I think it was the Pences who ran Telluride for years, ran it for a couple of years. And then Redford just decided to do Sundance, which, you know, stepped things up another notch.
Yeah, I mean, I came up in the time of the 90s, which was the birth like I was telling Rick Licklider when he was on the show, I was like, you know, you're kind of like the birth of the 90s independent film movement. And he's like, there was John before me. There was many others before me. I go, yeah, but the Sundance phenomenon, which is the overnight superstar, like the lottery tickets, like Rick and like Robert Rodriguez and Kevin Smith and Ed Burns and Steven Soderbergh. Yeah, and the list goes on. Spike Lee, these kind of guys. That was that moment in time. But, yeah, I always like to always let people know, especially filmmakers, to understand, like, if you were able to just make a movie in the 70s and 80s, if you finished it was sold. Like it didn't matter if it was good or bad.
It didn't necessarily get that much screen time but somebody would try to put it on the screen and see if it worked.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I wanted to go back real quick to your Roger Corman days, because is there anyone who did not go through Roger Corman? I mean, Jesus.
A lot of people went through it and their careers never really just, you know, took off.
Right.
Roger always said, I'm suspicious of anybody who works for me more than twice. if they're any good, they've probably moved on. But an awful lot of people did, you know, before me, Francis Coppola and Peter Bogdanovich and Jonathan Demme and Jonathan Kaplan and a whole slew of people.
Oh, God. The list goes on. The list goes on and on. And now what was it? So out of all the time that you were working with we were working with Roger. I mean, you did Piranha, which, you know, it's a classic. And then didn't you write also Alligator?
I did Alligator, which was not for Roger, but with Lewis Teague, who I had done Lady in Red at Roger's company with. And then I did The Howling with Joe Dante, but that was not at New World. I did Battle Beyond the Stars.
Yes, that's the one.
Which is, James Cameron ended up being made head of the production design.
Yeah.
And he met Horner, who did the soundtrack for it. And, you know, so it was the great thing about working there is that Roger, if he paid you for a screenplay, he wasn't going to waste that. He was going to make that movie. So for somebody to write 3 screenplays and see them on a screen within a year, that's very rare in Hollywood.
It's insane. It is insane to actually be able to do that.
And then for the directors as well, He basically said, here's the deal. Here's your budget. Here's your script. Don't go over, you know, make the best movie you can. And, you know, some of them were good and some of them less than good. And as he said, you know, if you're any good, you won't have to work for me again. So Ron Howard was there when I was, you know, working there. And Ron did two, I think he starred in one and then he directed another for Roger. And then he moved.
Right, exactly. And I have to ask you, what was the biggest takeaway you had from working with Roger at that time in your career? Like, what was that lesson that you're like, okay, I'm going to take this with me? And you used it throughout your career.
Certainly it was getting to go to the set. I got to go to the set of Piranha down in Texas for a couple days. And it was to see what can be done with just hard work and creativity, and what do you need to throw money at? And there's definitely, you know, a parting between those two. And so, you know, Joe Dante had $800,000 to make this Jaws spinoff. and he did what he could, you know, and some things cost money and some he just fudged it and found a way around the expense and still did a good job.
Right. I think if I remember Piranha, it was there was some of the Piranha shown, but I think he used a lot of the Spielberg book of saying, like, let's just see the aftermath as opposed to always seeing the Piranha hit.
You know, Joe had started in the editing room, you know, cutting trailers and then cutting features for Roger. There's a lot of fast cutting with all Piranha.
yes, there is.
It's about this many frames, if you remember cutting on film.
Yeah.
And then they don't look good anymore, you know, but with really good sound effects and good music by Pino Di Naggio, you know, Joe made it work.
Yeah, no question. Now, you've also edited many, I think, not all. Have you edited all?
I work with editors on about three of my 18 films.
Right, exactly. So, and you edited a lot of them yourselves. Do you find that filmmakers or directors specifically, what is the value you think being an editor brings to being a director? Because I've also been a cutter. I started off as a cutter, and it makes my life a lot easier on set because I'm like, I'm already editing it while I'm shooting. Do you find that as well?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Certainly if you're working on a tight budget and you're doing a little bit of coverage, you know, oh, I've got what I need. We're moving on. You know, so I often an actor will say, wait a minute, we only did three takes and I blew a line every take. And I say, yes, but you blew a different line every take and your acting was good and you didn't break character. And, you know, I've got this covered and we're moving on. I think the other thing is, you know, you don't need to edit your own movies, but I think it's a good experience to have had. You learn, oh, it would have been nice to have a close-up of this.
Cut away.
Have look left once, just in case, you know. So you learn more about coverage when you're editing, especially when you're editing something. You know, I'm always cursing the director when I'm in the editing room and saying, what an idiot. He didn't get cutaway to the dog or whatever.
Yeah,
you learn that stuff, you know, and then the next time out you cover things a little bit better and not necessarily hosing things down. It's, you know, something very specific will maybe get me out of a problem in the editing room later. And I'm going to get that specific thing right now.
I think you can never have too many cutaways. Have too many cutaways.
I've also done movies where I have done lots of master shots.
Sure.
Like, you know, 7, 8, 9 minute long master shots. And the things with master shots, if you're really going to get the crew into it, you have to commit to them. You know, they hate it when they see you stop and do some little bit of coverage, because why are they busting their balls?
Lighting and the movement. Yeah.
Yeah. And all that stuff. And so, you know, when I do those, I really commit to them.
Sure.
And
we'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
You know, build them up and rehearse them and everything. And then the great thing about that in your editing period is you come to that scene and you cut the lights off and you just cut 8 minutes and go to the beach.
When you're able to pull off one of those long takes, you're just like, oh, great. That was an easy cut. It was 8 minutes of the movie I don't have to worry about now. It's wonderful. And
usually that's the morning. 8 minutes is a great morning.
Oh, absolutely. No question. Now, is it true? I read somewhere that you did a lot of acting and writing assignments to kind of support the directing aspect of it, or to have freedom to do your own things. Is that kind of true?
Well, no, that's how I make a living.
Yeah.
You know, on my movies, I've a little better than broken even over the years, you know, because I have invested in my own movies.
Okay.
And very often, the Directors Guild and Writers Guild very nicely have said, well, if you're investing your own money, you don't have to pay yourself up front. If the movie makes money, then you pay yourself out back. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I do, and sometimes I you know, don't get to that point.
Mm-hmm.
I don't get paid, you know, I act for scale. So, you know, my acting is not going to finance anything.
Mm-hmm.
But I make a living as a screenwriter for hire. And that's usually the money that I have if I have to invest in my own project.
Right.
Or be one of the investors in my own project, just stuff that I've built over the years, you know, as a screenwriter for hire. Now, you know, I've written over 100 screenplays between my own movies and other movies, probably 45, 50 of them have been made. So I do get residuals. And that's a nice income when you have a fallow period and you don't get new work. You know, you've got some money coming in from those residuals. The Howling does very well around Halloween.
yes, it does. But you also do a lot of script doctoring as well.
Well, not really doctoring. I do a lot of rewriting.
Right. Yeah.
I've occasionally done doctoring. I think twice in my life I've done something where they said, can you just punch up this character?
Right.
You know, or can you run this through one time and that's going to be it. Generally, though, I'm given a script. They say this isn't working. Maybe they have an idea of what direction to go to. And then they just say, well, take it from there. So something like The Howling, you know, I had it. They gave me a script and they said, you know, keep the werewolves, keep the title. Can go. And that was fine. You know, and I didn't have much time to do it. And, you know, that was good also because then you don't get rewritten a million times by committees. You know, it's always nice to jump on the bus when it's about to go over the cliff because they're always you can do anything to put the brakes on. You know, they're happy about it.
That's actually.
But, yeah, I think, you know, if you're not willing to bet on yourself, I know Mel Gibson has done it a couple times. John Cassavetes used
Jesus.
To put a mortgage on his house. You know, to get movies made. And, you know, so I don't love the fact that I end up investing in my own movies, but I do it when I have to.
But the game has changed so much over the years in regards to investing in your own movies and making money with your own movies. I mean, back, like you said, in the 70s, 80s, even 90s and early 2000s, there was something called DVD. There was something called foreign pre-sales. There was a bunch of that kind of stuff where in today's world, it's so much harder for you to generate revenue from a film just because of the gluttony of content out there. I mean, you came up in a time when there was an ability to do that. I think it's much, much, much harder now from my experience in talking to filmmakers, making, trying to sell today.
You know, there's not as much of an audience going to non-Hollywood films.
Right.
You know, even before COVID, you know, that was kind of hard traceable cash. I remember when Steven Soderbergh was the president of the Directors Guild, he had a study done and it was something like 2% or less of directors' income was coming from their movies being shown on computers.
Wow.
And a higher and higher percentage of the people watching their movies were watching them on a computer.
Sure.
And so, you know, he was just basically saying, you know, the internet had not really been monetized for filmmakers. And now that more and more movies are made for things like Amazon and Netflix, mm-hmm. where they go into that thing, And who knows, you know, it's not, money is not passing hands individually on that movie. How do you know? You know, you get paid whatever they paid you to do it or to hand it over, and then you just don't know.
Yeah, exactly. There was that leak a few weeks ago about that they paid for Squid Games, I think, $21 million, but it's been seen by 180 million people. So if you try to monetize, I mean, can you imagine? I mean, that's a huge, but we don't get those numbers. So you're right. And I'd argue that the internet still hasn't been really, it's not really built to monetize for filmmakers now either. It's getting better, but it's not where it's still, it's not the olden days.
Something existed like this I'm in ASCAP and because I occasionally write lyrics for songs in our movies. And in the early days of ASCAP, they just sampled a certain number of stations. Mm-hmm. This is before computers. And so if you just played on eclectic stations, you might get nothing, even though your thing was, you know, playing here and there. You got nothing. And Michael Jackson got everything, you know, because he had the one hit that was playing everywhere. Now, almost every outlet that plays music is on computer, and their playlist is trackable. So people are actually doing a little bit better if they're getting any play time at all. Mm-hmm. But it's still, you know, the Michael Jackson equivalent is getting most of the money. Right. But you're getting something. It's just that there's so much out there that it's diluted so many times. That ideal thing where you make something, a person goes and sees it, they pay money, and the money goes directly to you. There's not that direct a chain anymore. It was never that direct. There were like five little things in between you and those dollars.
Sure.
But no, it's like it's all on the cloud. And who knows how that, you know, money's going to float back to you, the filmmaker.
Yeah. Now, when you, I mean, you've written, like you said, over 100 scripts at this point in your career. How do you start the process? Do you start, if you're doing an original script, do you start with character? Do you start with plot? How do you start the process?
I usually start with a combination of characters and plot, you know, so for me, it's a character or characters in a really interesting, difficult situation. And it may be a life or death situation. It may be a moral situation. It may be a life change situation, but that situation and those characters interest me. And then I start, you know, actually two or three times in the last couple of years, I've done this where I'll be being flown out to Los Angeles or flying myself out these days, to have, or something, and in that 6 hours I have an idea for a movie, and what I'll do is I'll just write all the scene headings and then like a one line of what happens in that scene, and by the time I get there I have maybe 20 pages of scene headings, which is like an outline for a movie, and it's got, you know, this, that it goes to this, and then it goes to this, and then it goes to this, and these are the places, and this is kind of what happens in it. And I'll look that over, and generally I'll just start filling it in. Now, as I fill it in, I'm adding characters. I'm, you know, going into depth with those characters sometimes. Sometimes I have to stop and do research. It may be something big. It may just be, okay, what kind of weapons would they use?
Right.
You know, I'm sure the, you know, Homeland Security, I'm high on their list of, oh yeah, right, the screenwriter, you know, he's blowing up the White House again.
Google how to blow up White House. Not a good thing.
But it kind of the plot and character come together. I write very fast. So I write a draft of a screenplay in about 3 weeks.
Wow.
And then generally, if I'm lucky, I'm working on something else and I'll go work on that. And then I come back to it. Or even if I'm not, I'll just do something else for a week or two. And the way my head works, when I come back, it's like, who wrote this? I don't recognize it. And so then you can really be much more critical when you're looking at it and trying to make it better. Every once in a while, it's like, geez, that's pretty good. You know, and other times it's like, ooh, boy, that's brutal. Gotta work on that.
No, I've had the exact same experience. Sometimes when I'm writing my book, sometimes I'll look at it. I'll like, who wrote this? Like, I'll just go the next day. I'm like, who wrote this? This is not bad.
Yeah.
You don't even recognize it. I always like to ask screenwriters and high performance individuals, where do you believe, you know, when you're writing, do you like tap into that? Are you in a flow, like the flow state? Are you tapping into something when you're writing, when you're sitting down, right? Like the muse, the old idea of the muse showing up. What is that thing? And do you know how to get to it pretty easily for yourself? Or is it hard?
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
You know, I'm still write novels. I've got a novel coming out late next year. That's like 800-page novel.
Wow.
And you know, you do movies for a while, and you don't do anything for a while, and then you decide, okay, I'm gonna try to do that thing as a novel. And there's like, for me, about 10 minutes of, do I still remember how to do this? And then I get interested in the story. And then, oh, this could happen. And oh, this could happen. And oh, this connects with something else. And then you're into it. And so there really is like a zone. Mm-hmm. And I'm lucky. And then I've never really had that, writer's block thing, which is, and part of it is that I'm willing to just kind of, you know, keep moving and say, better writing here. I'll work some of that out later. I don't know how to do this scene yet, so I'm going to go to the next scene and write that, and then maybe I'll know when I come back. So you just keep going forward. But I get into the zone pretty easily. And you know, I like writing, so it's fun, you know, to see where the story's going to go. And, oh, that, you know, I could connect this with this and all that. There's a lot of problem solving to it. So there's, you know, there's kind of a, almost like a crossword puzzle kind of thing. It's not something that's already there. You're creating it. But to make those connections and to build one thing on another. And then you always get to rewrite.
Right.
You know, so I don't too much about anything being perfect while I'm doing it, because I know I'm going to go over it. And, you know, half of the writing that I've done for hire has been rewriting other people's stuff. And I'm always happy to keep the good stuff, you know, and, you know, or the structure, if that's what they want me to keep. You know, I'm not shy about, you know, that's a great line. I'm keeping it. I don't care if I wrote it or not.
Right. Now, do you, you've also directed some amazing actors over the years. And I've noticed that you kept a lot of the same actors. You kept working with the same actors again and again. Do you have any advice for filmmakers directing actors? How do you pull a performance when an actor is not going exactly where you want to go?
Well, you know, some of it's just trust, and that's one of the reasons to work with people that you've worked with before.
Right.
You know, I tend to have big casts, and you know, you've got 20 people in the cast, and 8 of them are known to you. You've worked with them before. That's like, oh, I don't have to juggle 20 balls. I can put 8 of them on the floor, and I only have 12.
Right.
You know, to figure out how. You're there to help the actor, and the actor's there to help you. You know, it should be mutual. And so the first thing you want to do is really talk to that actor beforehand about, who's this character? And I mean before you get to the set. So I write a bio for every character. Even if the person has 3 lines, I write a bio for them. The bio may be longer than their screen appearance. You know, 4 pages is the most I've ever gone with anything. And it might be like a short story or something like that. And that's the stuff that's not necessarily in the script. You know, how long have you been married? You know, where's your life going right now? All those kind of things that would be helpful, that an actor would have to make up themselves. I want to make those things up and steer them in the direction. Then you talk to the actor, you know, usually on the phone in my case, because I can't afford to bring people in for rehearsals before I start to shoot. Just so you know you're on the same page. And then on the day, really what you want to do is just set the scene for the scene that they're going to be in, and then watch what the actor is going to do. that's where you start. Now, that may not be where you finish, but what you want to do when, you know, you're hiring actors because they're good and right. you think they're right for the part. Every once in a while, I've had an actor who really interpreted, without changing a line, something very differently than what I've imagined, and I've liked it better than what I imagined.
Mm-hmm.
That's why you want at least that first take to see where they're going to go with it, you know? And then you start to say, and you do these things incrementally, is okay, let's bring it more in this direction. Because, you know, all you're really, you know, giving actors is direction. You're not teaching them how to act. You're directing them. So let's move in this direction. Let's right. move in the direction where you are really, really pissed off and you're working really hard not to show. Okay. And then you go to the other actor who's in the scene and say, you know what you'd really love to do? You'd like to make this person break their cool. You know, you really, you know. So, you know, just give them a little needle on this now. And then you can have a different dynamic, you right. know. And so, you know, it's, I always say it's like, especially in two people scenes, it's like being the corner man for both fighters. And you run the other one and say, you know, hit him with a jab. And say, well, if he throws that jab, hit him with the other. and then you get it, you know, so you can change that dynamic each time and get something interesting. You have to handicap actors very quickly. Some actors are wonderful on their first take.
Right.
Their instincts are great. Their energy is all there. And then they start to complicate or lose energy. Those are actors you want to have technical things all really, really ready to go. And probably the camera is pointing at them first, so they're not stale from having the camera behind them, you know, for right. 6 or 7 tapes, you know. And then you have other actors who actually, you know, maybe they surround their lines, you know, they get closer every time. Well, maybe that's the person who you're over their shoulder for 4 takes before you turn the camera on them. And they've had time to walk around in the skin of the character a little bit. You handicap those things. The same thing with information. Some actors want a lot of information.
Mm-hmm.
I've had actors just say, give me a line reading. I don't care. I'll make it my own. And then other actors, it's if you complete a sentence, they're stop that, you know. And so what you really want to do is think of like 3 words that's going to get them in the direction that you want to get them. And they'll take it from there because anything else kind of gets in the way of their process. So you figure those things, you know, you can ask an actor before you start, how do you like to work? And they will tell you that's not always actually how they like to work.
That's how they think you want them to work.
Yeah. How they like to think about themselves as working. But when you find out what's really going to be helpful for them, you know, an actor's having a hard time with lines, a lot of what you have to do is depressurize that, you know. Mm-hmm. If it's an older actor, you say, you know, do you like to work with cue cards? No big deal. Well, just write them up, you know. Usually they'll say no, and sometimes they'll say yes, you know. You wish they had said yes earlier if they're at that point in their career. But what you have to do is defuse that, because when people get tense, they get even worse at their lines.
Right.
And so you just say, we'll do this one line at a time if we have to. Just, right. you know, keep your focus and stay in character. And don't always say cut. Just, you know, now, especially that we're not shooting on film, mm-hmm. and we don't roll out after 10 minutes, you can just keep rolling and keep the thing very, very kind of loose and you know, easy. And so much of my direction then is not, you blew a line. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the actor knows they blew the line. It's, you'll get the line. Really, you know, this time concentrate on this feeling or this undertone or this physical movement or whatever. And so that the criticism and the direction is not underlining the fact that they're blowing their lines. It's about the acting. It's about the character to keep them in character. It's, you know, it's a lot of work.
Yes,
and it's work because you really want to, you're there to help the actors. And if you've got people you've worked with before and they're good at it, sometimes they can really help you with that other actor. I've taken actors aside and said, okay, I need a little bit more out of this guy. Exaggerate your performance. I promise you, we are behind you.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now, back to the show.
You know, you can overact to beat the band on this one, and the camera's not going to see it. And I'm not, you know, going to cut out any bad stuff anyway. So you can just kind of, you know, chew the scenery in this one and see what you can get out of this person. I worked with a young kid in Mexico once, and I was working with Federico Lupi, this wonderful old Argentinian actor. And I said, well, I'm going to do this thing on Danny because he's getting, you know, like a lot of kids, he thinks, okay, my job is to learn my lines in order. And so I'm waiting for my cue for the next line. And I want him to learn the line. So he's a character. And when he's asked a question, he answers that question. And so I just said to Danny, you know, Federico's kind of old, and he probably won't blow his lines, but he may say them out of order. So you're going to really have to be on your toes and really know, you know, what you're listen to what he's saying, mm-hmm. you know, because he may throw you a curve and you're going to have to, but answer what he, you know, don't do your things in order. And then every once in a while, I had that Federico mess one up, you know, and the kid was so on his toes that he was really acting instead of saying
he wasn't in his head.
Turn, his turn, my turn, his turn, my turn.
Don't you find that sometimes with actors, you have to just kind of get them out of their own head? Sometimes, especially, I mean, experienced actors are different, but when you have young actors like that, they're getting in their head so much that you just have to take them out. And that's a brilliant technique you just laid out. That's a brilliant technique to get him to be out of his own head.
Yeah, I don't like to call them non-actors. I like to call them new actors.
Right.
And so very often with them, it's what do I do with my body, you know, because all of a sudden they're thinking about it, you know, and stuff. I'll give them something to do and I'll actually be specific about it. So I'll say, okay, you're going to be, you know, he's going to come and question you about it. You're going to be hanging up laundry. But the really important thing is put all the blue stuff up first and then put the red stuff up and then put the yellow stuff up. And then I'll have the props people mix them all up. So while they're like doing the laundry, they can't just be, you know, mind dead grabbing something and putting it up. They've got to look for the blue. They've got to really do something. They probably will not blow their lines, but they're going to have that little lack of, you know, like a person whose attention is divided. Like, I'm doing my laundry here. This guy just showed up and he's asking me questions. I got a job here, buddy. You know, and it takes them out of them worrying about what do I do with my hands, and you know how much time do I take before I answer him and anything like that, and how much eye contact and everything like that. They got a job to do, and that really I find helps. Occasionally, I'll just say, look, you know, we're shooting you from here. I want you to be even more uncomfortable. Lift up your left leg and balance on your right. Okay, let's shoot. You know, and all of a sudden the person is trying, but, you know, make sure you don't look shaky. You know, so the person is really concentrating on something and it gives them a subtext. Mm-hmm. Oh, geez, they're worried about something here. Well, they're worried about falling over. But to the camera, it's just like, what's going on with this person? You know, they're answering the questions, but something right. else is on their mind.
That's brilliant. Those techniques are gold. I hope everyone was taking notes on that one, because those are things that you only learn from doing, only learn from going again and again and again and again and being on set so many times.
And having been an actor. You know, and
that too.
And knowing what helps you as an actor, you know, especially day players, because that mostly the acting I've done in movies, in other people's movies, has been as a day player. And the important thing to know when you're a day player is you walk on the set and the crew looks at you as a liability. Is this guy going to kill us today? Are we going to be here all day? you know, we're going to get behind, you know, and that once you're done, you are furniture. When you, you know, when you're wrapped, get out of the way because they've got stuff to do, you know? And so you're there for a very, very specific thing. And, you know, as a day player, one of the main things you have to do is just remember this movie's about me. Mm-hmm. That's my character's idea. I'm going to go on, you know, the camera may stay there with that idiot, but I'm the star of this movie and I have to play it that way. But in the real world, I'm furniture.
<You know>? No, you're right.
I'm that the star's going to get into character and all that kind of shit. I've got to be ready with this thing. And, you know, just open yourself up to the script supervisor who sure. can help you. And the director who can help you and just say anything else you need, you know, and be as generous to the other actor who's in the scene with you as you can be. That day player thing is I really value people who can come in and just nail a scene
and out
and goodbye. You know?
Did you ever, on one of those times that you acted in someone else's project, did the director pull you aside and go, John, how do you, what do you think about this scene? How do you think I should shoot this?
Well, not during it. I was in a movie with that Bertrand Tavernier directed in Louisiana, and John Goodman and Tommy Lee Jones were in it. Mm-hmm. And nobody pulled me aside while I was acting, but they started fighting over the cut. The director and the producer and the actor kind of went in different directions.
Oh, God.
And so all of a sudden they're asking me to look at the thing. And I said, guys, I'm a day player. You know, I can't tell you what the cuts. And finally, I said, okay, I'll watch both of the cuts and I'll tell you exactly what exactly what I thought of them. And I thought, you know, these are both valid ways to cut this movie. And, you know, Bertrand's is more poetic and the one that Tommy Lee and the producer made, you know, it makes more sense, probably literal sense for an American audience. And they did what is rare, which is the smart thing, which is they finally decided in Europe it was Bertrand's cut. And in the United States, it was the producer and, yeah. you know. And so they could all, you know, say nice things about the movie when they did their you know.
Press tour.
Yeah. yeah. But no, you know, you really, when you're acting in somebody else's movie, you're really trying to help them make their day and make the scene come alive.
Right.
You know, and, you know, a couple times I've been on, like I wrote a TV show years and years and years ago and called Shannon's Deal. And I came to do a part in an episode, and it was like, you know, the fifth episode or something like that. And every single actor who had a recurring part came to me because they knew that I was the head writer on this thing. I said, you know, in episode 7, they got me in a chicken suit. You know, my character wouldn't wear a chicken suit. I said, guys, you know, I'm the writer. I'm not the producer. But, you know, you have to figure that they figured – I'm talking to God here, the one who writes the parts. And to a certain extent, it is good for actors to butter up the writer in a TV series.
Absolutely.
You know, good writers, when they see an actor start to take off or do something interesting, you know, especially for a series that you're trying to stretch into another season, it's like, oh, I could hang something on that. You know, we could go somewhere with that guy.
Now, as a director, I think every director – who's ever directed a movie, there's always that day in production where everything is falling down around them. The world is coming. Yeah. The world is coming to an end. Either you are at that moment going, I'm a fraud. This is horrible. I'm not going to make my day. The sun is going down. What was that moment for you in any of your films and how did you overcome it?
Yeah, I mean, there was a scene in my second movie, Liana, where I just said, we're never going to leave this room. You know, this is like the Terminating Angel. This is like that Buñuel movie.
Yeah.
And because, you know, just a light would break and somebody's stomach would boing right in the middle of a good scene.
Jesus.
You know, it just wasn't happening. And I did that. And the same thing happened when we were making Lone Star. There was a walk and talk between Chris Cooper and Liz Pena alongside the Rio Bravo. And it just wasn't good. And both times I said, you know, I think I have to rethink this scene. We're going to shoot this again and let's move on. And so you just get out of there and then you have time to rethink it. And sometimes it's, I'm not going to change anything, but I'm going to appear to change things. So you move the camera back and you put a longer lens on and you got the same image, but it seems like you've done something different, you know. Right. You know, I fucked up the angle, you know, let's change this thing. And so it's not on the actors if they're part of the problem. And it doesn't seem stale. So I reblock the walk and talk slightly. I move some lines around.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
I made like one good cut of a line and a transposition or something. And I remember I got there. This is, you know, down on the border near Eagle Pass. And I got there. I skipped lunch that day and I went and I laid down on a hot rock and thought about how am I going to restage this thing so the actors feel like they're doing something totally new from what we did yesterday. Mm-hmm. Then I started hearing the crew arrive and everything. And I looked up in the sky and there were five buzzards circling over me. It looked like there was a dead man in a rock. You know, I thought, okay, you got to wait. And then I explained it to them as, you know, I think I figured this out and I've changed some lines here and a slight change in the blocking. And it was new enough that the actors came at it with a totally mm-hmm. different energy. And we did two takes and we were gone. So a lot of it is just kind of just change the dynamic a little bit. Sometimes it just means everybody's tired and you should go home. Mm. Important to know that you're just going to do 2 hours of bad work. Why not go home and get 2 hours of decent sleep? And then you'll catch up at some point. Sometimes it's that, you know, something has gone stale. A hard thing for movie actors that you don't have in theater, because I've acted in theater too, is that when you've got to make everything seem new and it's not in order. Yeah. And often when you're in trouble in a scene is because you're playing the end of the scene because you know what happens at the beginning of the scene.
Right.
And that's so hard to forget that on take 12, especially if it's kind of a long scene. Well, whereas if you change the dynamic or come back another day, you have more energy for it, you know, and if it's different. It's different. It's not the same scene. It doesn't have to be that much different. It's not the same scene. And all of a sudden, you find another way to do it, and it comes alive a little bit.
Did you ever use that old editor's trick where if you have a producer that you have to appease or a studio that you have to appease, that you throw in a red herring in the cut to have them have something that's so obviously not supposed to be there, where they can go, you need to change that in scene six. And you're like, oh, thank you for seeing that. But you knew that was going to go out anyway.
Yeah. You know, I really only have had that battle once when I was making Baby It's You with Paramount. And they just decided they wanted a high school comedy halfway through the shooting of the movie.
Jesus.
And it wasn't written to be a high school comedy. It was never going to be Porky's or Fast Times at Ridgemont High. But I really just said, I'm just going to make the movie. I'm going to cut the movie that I think is the best movie. And then we're going to fight over it. And I got kicked out of the editing room.
Wow.
They did their cut. They test marketed it. Their test marketed 1 point worse than my cut. So they very grudgingly gave me back the movie to cut. And, you know, there were a couple of things they'd done. you know, just kind of physical guts that I liked, and I kept those, and I threw everything else and went back to what I had before. But I didn't want to test them with that kind of stuff. There wasn't a censorship problem, which I think you can get right. with sex and violence. You can get a sure. censorship problem. And then sometimes it does make sense to just like, let's just hit them with everything. And so in such shock and awe that if we cut right. six things out and leave the four that we really want, you know, they'll be happy and think that they've won the battle. And, you know, people would do that with the MPAA as mm-hmm. well, as they leave a couple things in that they could concede. Okay, you forced me to give up my favorite shot, you know, when it's not my favorite shot at all. I haven't really had to do that kind of gamesmanship. What I do is when I do screenings, I don't do the fill out a form. Did you like this? Did you not like this thing? That's so subjective. My questions are all, did you understand this? Because that's when you lose an audience, is when right. they don't understand, when things are confusing,
right.
you know, and that's usually the feedback I get from an audience that means the most and makes me, you know, change cuts. And then also just kind of sitting with my back to the screen and watching an audience watch it and feel them reacting to the picture, mm-hmm. you know. And does this seem like they're treading water a little bit? Should we get to something quicker?
Yeah.
You know, it's good to have, you know, people who did not work on the movie see it. But people who you think are going to like it or could like it. The problem with those invited screenings that they did is, you know, they did a test of Baby It's You. And there was a rumor going on, you know, in Paramus or wherever it was, that it was a Burt Reynolds picture. Well, some of our bad numbers were probably because people were pissed because Burt Reynolds never showed up. The son of a bitch.
When's Burt Reynolds going to show up in this movie?
Yeah.
Now, in your film Lone Star, honestly, when I saw Lone Star, I probably was in film school or right before it. And I, for the first time, really saw the transitions you did to transfer time. I remember like it was all in the same shot. So you'd start off in the bar and you would pan over and then it was in the past. And it was done so masterfully. Where did you get the inspiration for those shots? Because I've seen Coppola do it in not with time as much, but I thought on Dracula and in Tucker and things like that. But yours was the first time I really kind of noticed that mastery in that scene transition. Did you get inspired from somebody? Or did you come up with that?
No. I had seen, you know, tricky master shots before and stuff like that. I think there might have been a couple Italian movies who might do that once in a film or whatever.
Sure.
But I actually like those kind of transitions. I remember I wrote the screenplay for Clan of the Cave Bear.
Yeah, Daryl Hannah.
And originally it was going to be a TV movie. And in the TV movie, you had like seven commercial breaks. And so when there was going to be, you know, a time montage, you could get rid of the time montage and just you cut to a commercial break. And, you know, so, you know, we see some little blonde girl get saved from a saber-toothed tiger that, you know, scratches her thigh, you know, and leaves claw marks on her thigh. You cut from that to the commercials, and then, you know, 7 minutes later, you cut to Daryl Hannah's thigh, and it's got this scar on it, and you pan Done. Up to her face, and it's Daryl Hannah, and that many years have passed, you know. So I often thought about transitions and how different they are in a feature. They're different than in a TV movie, and, you know, and what a transition does as far as time is concerned. And so I was interested in how do I do a transition where I underline the fact that we're living with the past. Mm-hmm. It's not, this is now, that was then. Mm-hmm. It's, this is now, and then is right on our shoulders. Then is, you know, loading the dice with everything we do now. And that's the kind of town that we're in. And so I thought up these shots where we would go from, present day, back 27 years or whatever it was, 17 years, I forget how many years it was, and without a cut. And then you sit with your production designer and your lighting guy and your grip department, and you figure this shit out. And it's really fun for them to do.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's like, I'm going to do this. You know, oh, well, you know, when we come back, the place has to be redesigned. So we have to have stuff that we can just stick on the walls and stick on the columns, yeah, you know, really quickly.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And, you know, Cliff James is a big guy and he's in his 70s. He's not going to be able to get out of that chair quickly enough. So we're going to have two grips lift him in the chair up and run ahead of the camera and get him out.
Oh, those are the best. Those are the best. I love those shots.
And, you know, we got other ones where we're going to start on two cops walking down the street being harried by these two civilian ladies. And then as they go behind the car that they're going to get into, our camera operator is going to step onto a platform on the side of the cop car that has to be slid in after the driver gets in. So that I need to give him two lines there for that to happen. When the guy slides in, he shuts the door. We hold on the guy on the other side still standing up. But by the time we come down and look through the window, there's this platform. Our DP has, you know, operator has stepped up on it and they can drive away with him. And now we've got a moving two shot without a cut. And then they can get out and we can follow them into a building, you know. Well, those for a grip department, it's so much fun. There's guys sliding under cars with Makita drills and, you know, and only pulling the trigger in between lines and stuff like that. And, you know, putting magnets on with light units on the front of the car because you saw the car first,
right,
naked, and it's got to have all this rigging on it, you know. And you know, that's maybe half a morning of rehearsal just for all that mechanic stuff, and then you start working the actors in, and we'd make three takes, and then, you know, it's lunchtime and you're done. They're so much fun. And satisfying for a crew and for the actors and stuff. And there's a nice kind of energy and spirit for the actors that comes with them. Mm-hmm. There's the challenge, you know, you're doing a 9-minute scene and you come in at 8:30 and you have three lines. You don't want to blow those lines. The actor pissed at you.
Oh my God.
We had that happen. The guy who had the last line blew his line because he'd been waiting for so long, you know, and we said, well, just do another one and you'll be better this time.
And then slowly you go, you better be better this time. Now, I have to ask you, you know, you also got to direct a young up and coming musician back in the 80s by the name of Bruce Springsteen. How did you get hooked up with Bruce and like direct some of the most iconic music videos of that era?
Kind of evolved. When we did Baby It's You, which was, you know, set in Trenton, New Jersey, and, you know, during the 60s, and even though the music that we used wasn't from that era, there were four songs of his that I really felt like iconically belonged in that movie, just as, and they're not coming from jukeboxes or anything, so we're not pretending they were written then. They're kind of the more authorial music in the movie. And we just contacted his management and said, look, we would love to use these songs. We're going to cut the movie together, put the songs in, you get to see it. If you hate it, we have backups. If you like it, we'll make a deal, you know. And then as it turned out, they liked the movie, they liked the way the music was used, and were very generous with their half of the music rights.
I think
the record label, the performances, they owned the publishing, and they were very generous with the publishing, which was, you know, great, because, you know, we could buy some other songs. So we had that contact. Then Maggie Frenzy, who I'm married to and has produced a bunch of my movies, her sister did a PBS movie a dance movie. She's a choreographer that used Springsteen music. And the thing with PBS is you can use anybody's music and it's free because it's public television. So if you saw the Vietnam series mm-hmm. that Burns did, every hit of the 60s.
You're absolutely right. I never thought about that.
Thrown away, 28 seconds of Rolling Stones in the background because you don't have to pay for them.
Oh my God, I never even thought about that.
You could finance a country for what Stacey has to pay for some of his soundtracks, but for PBS, it's just like you want it, you got it. Marta was able to get that movie to Bruce, and through that we kind of met Bruce and the people who kind of ran his business for him. And I think it was right after the Dancing in the Dark video, he wanted to do Born in the USA kind of gritty. And they called us up and said, hey, I do gritty. and he had, so I did the three videos for Bruce. And they were, basically his ideas. And I certainly had, they weren't big budgets, but it was certainly more money than I'd ever had to make 2.5 minutes of film.
Sure.
Plus I got to cut Springsteen music, at the end of the day. So they were really fun to do. A little difficult in the case of Glory Days in that he had just gotten married and was more famous than anybody on the planet for, about 3 months. And so I remember we were driving out to where we're going to do the intro on a baseball field. And there's a rock and roll station helicopter following us, reporting where our is going, just in case we need more people hanging out and screwing up our shot.
Oh, Jesus. But
they were fun. And the E Street Band was fun. For the first one, we got to film 4 concerts. So we get to see 4 Bruce Springsteen live concerts. at least. Or sitting clothes every night, so that there was some continuity in it. That was kind of when, rock videos, I think there was an important role that they did for upcoming directors. Mm-hmm. So many upcoming directors cut their teeth on those mm-hmm. with a real budget, mm-hmm. with cranes and fog and all the shit that you usually can't afford.
Techno cranes and stuff like that, yeah.
Yeah. Creative things with them. So that was a nice era, I think, for upcoming filmmakers.
Especially the 90s when like the Finchers and Michael Bay and Fuqua and Spike Jonze. You look at some of those old Fincher, like Aerosmith, Janie's Got a Gun. It's a masterwork. He had all the money in the world. It was insane.
Yeah. And many of them are kind of like very small movies with all the kind of dialogue cut out, And they had to look good, and it was very competitive, those kind of things. And the record companies still kind of existed and still had money to spend on those things.
Oh, God, so much money in the 90s.
And then it disappeared fairly quickly.
Yeah, I remember working in Miami when I was coming up as an editor and working like $200,000-$300,000 budget music videos on like B and C level acts. Not like A. A levels would be getting $500,000, $1 million, $1.5 million. It's insane. It was a different time.
feature films in my world.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
$500,000, I'll make a feature.
Absolutely. No question. Now, is there any advice you wish you would have heard at the beginning of your career?
I think I could have used about a week of film school. Just for some technical things that would have been helpful. On my first movie, I wish I had trusted my instincts a little bit more. Right. My crew having late 70s shooting commercials, everything was kind of rock steady and very clean, and the shaking cam thing on MTV hadn't started yet. And I wanted a more found documentary look to it and handheld. And I would have been happy to have almost the whole movie handheld. Mm-hmm. And they just said, oh no, it's going to look terrible. People are going to get sick. It's going to be shaky.
Right.
then just to have some movement in the movie, there are two sequences in Secaucus 7, one mm-hmm. where these guys are playing basketball and they work a thing out, and another where the whole bunch of them are playing volleyball, and then a third one where they're playing charades. And I got the operator to hand hold, and it turned out he was a great handheld operator. He had worked for, forget the guy's name, who made all the skiing films, Warren Miller.
Oh, wow.
And my operator used to ski down a hill and duck his head between his legs and shoot upside down and backwards as people skied down a hill behind him.
Wow.
And he used to shoot the Dartmouth football games handheld, you know. So he was a great handheld operator. He just didn't think it belonged in a feature movie because that's the commercial feature world that he was thinking of. You know?
Sure.
So I think some is, look, you know, trust your instincts and then live with them. So if your instincts are wrong, then you go in the editing room and you try to fix things. But
we'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And then I think it would also just be don't say cut so quickly.
Oh, God, yeah. That's one of the best pieces of advice I heard. I forgot who it was. It's like when you're
my first one, because we were running out of 16 millimeter. We were up in New Hampshire. We didn't want to over, you know, buy stock because you mm-hmm. couldn't really give it back or want anything like that. So it came on the Trailways bus twice a week. and we just kind of parceled it out. And so I was always really, you know, cut right on the thing because if I've got 2 minutes left on that 10-minute reel, you know, I got a, you know, minute and 52-second scene that I can get in there, a take that I can get in there. And I didn't want to blow that and have short ends. But so often I cut a little too close or there was a nice reaction from an actor. You know, and it's the great thing about digital now, which is
you let it go.
I think it was Tom Hanks and Matt, what's his name, on a show who had done a Clint Eastwood movie. And they said, well, so, you know, because Clint was, you know, notoriously low key on a set. And, you know, instead of action, it's kind of, OK, let's get into this, guys. And they were saying that they had to get used to Eastwood saying when he was done with something, okay, that's enough of that. which is better than cut too quickly, you know. But there is a nice thing, which is that sometimes what you get at the very end, it may not even be for that scene. But
yes.
There's a reaction. It could be in a face because they hated their take. But that face can work.
I heard that same advice somewhere. Someone said, like, when you're about to yell cut, wait 5 seconds. Yeah. And just hold it for 5 more seconds, even when you want to cut, because you just never know. And I've been in the editing room so many times, I've grabbed a look, a movement, something from exactly what you just said, an actor hating their take or something, going like, ugh. And it's perfect for another scene.
I also learned early, doing conversations especially, to just say, okay, keep going, stay in character. Okay, look left at the guy. Now look right at something.
Done.
And every once in a while, you need that right look, you know, or that left look. And you don't have to flip something and have, you know, the
the logo they have to digitally remove.
Yeah.
Now I'm going to ask you a few questions to ask all my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
I would say, you know, you're a filmmaker, make a film. And importantly, do something that you think you can do well. So let's say you wrote a nice 90-minute feature and it can star, you know, new actors or people, you know, kind of a mixed bag of people who are pretty good actors or very new at it or whatever. See if you can go out and make that movie for no money. you know, with the best equipment you can get,
mm-hmm.
and then call it a rehearsal and look at it. And if there's 20 minutes that you think is great after you cut it together, you have that to start showing around. You may get to make that very movie again with ideal people, some of the same, some of different, whatever, and you've already had a great practice run. But really learn what works, what you did well, and that's what you show. But I think the best way now to get discovered is not, you know, necessarily knowing somebody or, you know, showing, you know, oh, my film school teacher thought I was wonderful, you know, which it's no. Is to have something to show, you know, and then you're going to have to give it away. You know, you have to put it online, you know, and try to, you know, get it seen wherever you can. Volunteer, you know, if you got a film school near you, if you're an actor, you volunteer to be in all those movies. You know, I got Chris Cooper for Make One, who had never been in a movie before. He'd done quite a bit of theater,
mm-hmm.
Because he was in my production office coordinator's student film at NYU. Nancy Savoca had used Chris Cooper and when he was just an acting student in New York, and she said, you got to see this guy. You know, he volunteered, you know, and he met Nancy and he did a good job in her film and she really liked working with him and she talked him up. So as an actor, you know, just find out who's making movies and say, you know, here I am. I'm not in the guild yet. I'm giving it away. You know,
and, yeah, and you've and it worked out with you and Chris. Chris did; he's done okay for himself over the years.
Yeah. You know, and it's you know, if I hadn't discovered him, somebody else would have. But
right.
In those days, I somehow got away with making a, you know, $3.2 million movie with an actor who, as a lead, who'd never been in a movie before.
That's insanity.
That's not, yeah.
Yeah, that's insanity. That would never happen in a million years. Now it just doesn't.
Yeah. But I mean, I think, you know, think about, you know, you've written a bunch of scripts. What's the one that you could do for almost no money with friends? And it would be watchable. Wouldn't be ideal. It would be watchable. Or is there a scene from it that shows, you know, some part of your directing that you think is really good or some part of your writing that thing, you know, you just do that scene. It's doable. No, it used to be that would cost you money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even on an amateur level, it would cost you money. You'd have to buy film stock and rent,
right.
you know, 16 at least equipment. Now it does not have to cost you any money.
And
here's the thing though about that, which is you and your collaborators, the hardest thing for you to survive and stay friends will be success.
That's great advice.
You know, I've seen this happen a bunch of times, you know, when a movie comes out of nowhere and gets to be a success, really only the director, maybe an actor and maybe the producer, but probably not, will get any attention. And they really are going to have to grab onto whatever that is and get a deal for another movie or whatever. And other people may be jettisoned, you know. Which is A, why I say on your first movie, you can pay people nothing. On your second movie, you either have to pay people something or get new friends who are also just starting out, you know,
right.
So it's a big deal for them. But also just understand that, you know, credit doesn't go to the team.
Yeah.
Very few collectives have stayed together for more than one picture. So really think of, you know, and be honest with each other of what you're getting out of this is the experience. You know, I know people who had a big success at Sundance. And
mm-hmm.
One of the great things they were able to do is they said, we are renting a condo. Anybody who worked on the picture, if you can get your ass here, come and you're invited to the party and you're invited to the movie. And that's it. We can't afford to bring you there. And that may be it. That may be a reward, you know, is the fun of that party and having worked on something that's good.
And how about for screenwriters? I mean, because you've just written so much. Well, how about screenwriters trying to come in and break in today?
Yeah, if you're only a screenwriter and you went to film school, try to buddy up to some of the people we think were really interesting directors.
Okay.
An awful lot of people coming through film school think they have to be writer directors. I'm a writer director. There are a few writer directors.
Mm-hmm.
The Coen brothers are writer directors. There's a lot of really good directors who have a good story sense, but they're not writers.
Right.
And they need writers.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And if you're a screenwriter, that's who you want to hook up with. Somebody who think you really has a nice visual style, who has interesting ideas, who has a good story sense. And then you say, oh, you want some material to try your hand on. And once again, it might only be a scene, but hook up with those people. It's a really hard thing as a screenwriter to break in. As I said, you know, I broke in by having written two novels and a short story collection.
Right.
And that got an introduction to a film agent.
You know? Right.
Somebody read one of my short stories. And then, you know, and when I wrote a screenplay, I had only read one screenplay. Somebody gave me a copy of William Goldman's screenplay for The Stepford Wives.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew that. Because there weren't film writing books then, so
right.
I at least knew the. And I read it, and I realized, God, I could do that. It's one of the more, you know, it's very simple screenplay. It's kind of a no-brainer. You know, I said, well, I could do that. You know, so it actually was good for my confidence. If this guy gets $500,000 for running things through his typewriter, you know, I could do that. You know, just give me a great premise, but you know, just kind of knowing that, and then really having this thing is okay. I'm writing for a reader, and so this thing has to read exciting, and it has to have the rhythm of a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so you really have to think about your white space and your
yes.
your chopping things up and cross-cutting and not too much description. You know, my favorite example of great description is a Raymond Chandler story where he has this line, the detective goes to somebody's sleazy office and he says, he gave me a drink of warm gin in a dirty glass. That's the only description of the office. You know, that's all you need. If you can find that equivalent, you've got one little slug line, you know, don't be saying, oh, and then we see this and we see that, you know, that's for the, you know,
production design.
You can get it down to those one or two lines, you know, and maybe it's funny or whatever, and keep the rhythm of the thing going so that it reads like a house on fire, if that's the rhythm of the screenplay. But you know, this is the movie right now. And then later on, the director's going to say, well, I need to know more about this, 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 and this, and this. That's after you've got the green light. And you can put all that stuff in. But the first thing you're writing is a selling document. And that's just got to just be exciting to read and have a page-turning quality.
What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
That you can't predict the future. And there's a thing called the Monte Carlo fallacy.
Mm-hmm.
And it, gambling, and which is basically, okay, you're playing roulette. Just because the ball went on the black 10 times in a row doesn't mean that it's more likely to go on the white the next spin. It's still a little less than 50-50 because there's you know the one green space. So when you're not getting any work, that doesn't mean you'll never get any work again. And when you are getting work, that doesn't mean you're always going to get work. That there is so much luck involved in it, no matter what your talents. There's, you know, I know actors who have had terrible time because they did good work in three movies in a row and those movies didn't get released.
Right.
You know, it's like they died. Does that actor have like a substance abuse problem? What happened to that actor? Well, they disappeared because the movies didn't get released, not because the actor did bad work, you know, and that was over a year and a half, 2 year period, you know, and it's just like they disappeared. Well, they're off the list. That can happen with writers as well. So you really have to just keep slugging away at it and not let it get you down. You have, in terms of life, you have to be realistic. And if you're, you know, I've been lucky and I've gotten to the point where I've made a living as a writer for a long time now, mm-hmm. pretty much interrupted by maybe a year or two of no work, but enough money coming in that I didn't have to take a different kind of job. If you're younger, if you have kids, you may have to take another kind of job.
Right. You know?
And then you have to really make that decision of what kind of job can I take where I still have the energy and willpower to go home and crank at the, you know, the keyboard for a couple hours.
Right.
Because I really, you know, doing that. When I was first sending out short stories, I found that when I worked in a sausage factory or a plastic factory, I could come home and I could work for 3 or 4 hours. No human contact, just noise, you know, and, you know, kind of rote, you know, routine, you know, motions and physical work, but nothing mental. When I worked in hospitals and had to deal with people, I was too exhausted to work at all. Right. And they paid the same. So probably the non-human contact job was a better one to also have a career as a writer than one with a lot of human contact. Don't be a social worker.
No. No way. Is there a lesson that you learned from your, what is the lesson you learned from your biggest failure in life, in the film industry?
I would say, that the movie is going to last for a long, long time. And that the compromises that you're willing to make with a movie are going to haunt you if you feel you sold your own movie out.
Yep.
And so it cost quite a bit career-wise, maybe. And, you know, my hair should still be blonde. I hung in and, you know, on Baby It's You. And I said, look, you know, you financed this movie. It belongs to you. I'm just not going to put my name on it unless it's a cut that I believe in. And finally, it was one of those deals where they said, they kind of threw it back at me and said, okay, cut it the way you want to. And then pretty much told people, do not do any work on this movie. We're going to let it escape. We're not going to release it. And so that was kind of a vindictive release of mm-hmm. the movie.
This is so counterproductive.
But, you know, that happens all the, you know, it especially happens when new people take over a studio and they kill the cubs, you know. But in this case, it was like they had some other successes and you know, they just wanted to get this thing off their hands and not look bad. But the movie's still good and I still like the movie. So I don't have to kind of say, oh, God, I wish I had held out, you know, and. You know, and so that was, in some ways, it was a failure because the communication broke down and, you know, didn't go as well as it should have. On the other hand, we turned out the way that I thought it should.
Good. And last question, 3 of your favorite films of all time.
Yojimbo.
Amazing.
After Kurosawa.
Of course.
You know, just kind of the music, the
character. Oh, everything.
The rhythm,
everything, you know,
camera angles, just really fun to watch again and again. Treasure of Sierra Madre, mm-hmm. Which is just a great Hollywood movie. You know, by certainly an independent spirited director, you know, John Huston would, you know, he got himself down to Mexico and we're far from, you know,
yep.
probing. and made a really, really good movie. Yeah. And drank a lot of tequila, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. And it plays like an independent movie to me, you know. Yeah. And has a real kind of soul to it. And then Two Women, which is a Vittorio De Sica movie with Sophia Loren.
Yes, yes, yes.
Just really, really moving World War II movie. And it's the kind of my introduction to European cinema. I didn't see a movie with subtitles until I was in college. Right. I just saw, you know, foreign movies on TV if they played them at all. And if they weren't in English language, they were dubbed. So I saw the dubbed version first with commercials, and it still, you know, got me to cry, mm-hmm. you know. And, you know, just kind of.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Depth of humanity of it. You know, beautiful performances, and De Sica had a really, really human touch. So, you know, those three movies, you know, to me just got me interested. How could you actually, because most movies weren't like that, you know,
right?
I liked and mainstream movies and everything like that, but those were ones that really jumped out at me when I saw them.
And when's your next movie? When are we going to see another John Sayles movie?
Boy, when I get one financed. Like most screenwriter directors, I have three, maybe four, just add money. You know, we're working on a couple now. I got to work with Doug Trumbull, mm-hmm. Special effects guy who also did Silent Running and Brainstorm.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
We're working together on something that we would co-direct, a kind of big science fiction thing.
Oh my
I've
God.
Got a that we shoot in Mexico. I've got a kind of one location barroom movie with John Cusack in Chicago that, you know, should be easy to finance. That's my COVID hotline. I should call them back. Anyway, so they're trying to trace me.
Yes, no problem. But John, thank you again so much for being on the show, man. I hope someone listening, please finance John's next movie. but I appreciate this has been a masterclass in directing and writing, and I truly appreciate your time and your career and all the work you've done and inspiration you've given a lot of filmmakers over the years. So John, thank you so much for being on the show, my friend.
Thanks a lot, Alex.
I want to thank John so much for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Thank you again so much, John. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/518. And if there is somebody out there who wants to finance a movie, John Sayles needs some money. Like we said in the interview, someone finance his film so we can see another John Sayles movie, for God's sakes. It's been way, way too long. Thank you guys again so much for listening. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there. And I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at indiefilmhustle.com. That's INDIEFILMHUSTLE.com.